The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Age of Glory, the Gaonic Era, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmos, Moshe ben Vero, V'chaya Feige Bas Binyamin Aleihem HaShalom, Mr. and Mrs. Milton and Irene Blavin of blessed memory.
One of the most significant discoveries of the 20th century, one that forever changed the way we look at the world, was Einstein's theory of relativity. As Einstein pointed out, how we calculate the speed that we travel depends on our frame of reference. For instance, if you're traveling in a train that's going at a speed of 80 miles an hour, another train passes you on the other track, going in the opposite direction, also at 80 miles an hour. In reference to the other train, you're actually going 160 miles an hour. Because after an hour's time, one train is 160 miles away from the other train. So vis-a-vis the other train, says in an hour, you have traveled 160 miles. In reference to a point on the ground, though, you're only going 80. If another train in the next track travels with you in the same direction, it's not opposite, but with you, in tandem, at 80 miles an hour, again, relative to that train, you're standing still. Because after an hour, you're still, relative to that train, you're still in the same place. Even though in relationship to the ground, you've actually traveled 80 miles in that hour. It's all relative to your frame of reference. Hence the name, the theory of relativity. There's one thing, however, that is absolute. No matter which way you're traveling, the speed remains constant. And that is the speed of light. Light can never get faster or slower. No matter what your frame of reference is, light always travels at 186,000 miles per second. How to explain this anomaly and how it makes it different in every aspect of physical reality is the essence of Einstein's theory. Just as an aside, the actual theory is highly complex, involves intricate mathematical equations, and created a revolutionary way of viewing time and space. After the publication of Einstein's general theory of relativity, because actually there are two, there's the special theory and the general theory, the British astronomer Sir Arthur Eddington, one of the first to fully understand the theory in detail, was once asked if it was really true that only three people in the world understand the theory. He is said to have replied, "Who's the third?" And it reminds me of a very cute story. That when the theory first came out, and everyone was talking about this theory, a Jewish immigrant who had worked very hard to put his son through school asked his son, who he felt is a well-accomplished scholar, to explain the theory to him. The son, despite his schooling, was pretty fuzzy about the theory himself. But he decided to explain it in the following manner to his father. He says, "Dad, let's say you're sitting in front of a Gemara and you're learning. Hours seem like minutes. But if you're sitting on top of a hot stove, this is seconds seem like days. It's all relative." And the father looks at his son, he says, "And from them after 11, like he can make a living off of this." But the idea of an absolute frame of reference is not unique to physics. It is a phenomenon which exists in history as well. History is the study of change. Migrations, wars, empires, economies, ideologies, and people. The world today is far different than the world that existed at the time of the Talmud. Islam was unknown. Rome ruled the world. The only residents of America were Indian tribes. There was no electricity, printing, or air travel. A Jew transported by a time machine from Talmudic times to our own would have much difficulty. Until, of course, he walked into a kollel or a yeshiva. There he would feel right at home. The world has experienced much change, but the light of the Torah, just like Einstein's light, remains absolute and to an astonishing degree unaffected. Empires were built and destroyed, religions and ideologies rose and set, and the Jew remains in the Beis Medrash, the yeshiva, immersed in his studies and faithful to his ideals. Perhaps no time in history better illustrates this phenomenon than the era that we'll be studying this year, the era of the Gaonim. The Gaonim were the Rosh Yeshiva, the heads of the Torah academies of Bavel, Babylon, today's Iraq. These academies or yeshivas were located in Pumbedisa and Sura, in northern and southern Iraq, near the Euphrates. The Gaonim were the spiritual, intellectual giants of their generation and had an inordinate influence on Jewish life throughout the world. They flourished between the years 589 and 1038. The almost 500 years that we'll be covering in this lecture series was a time of tremendous upheaval. The Byzantine Empire reached its zenith only to be toppled by a group of barbarians with a pure vision and greater motivation, the Arabs. Persia, with its Zoroastrian faith and large empire, was also swallowed up, as well as were Afghanistan, Pakistan, North Africa, and Spain, by the armies of the disciples of Muhammad. But these barbarians soon became the avant-garde of culture and science. While Christian Europe was in the Dark Ages, the works of Aristotle and Plato came to be studied in earnest in the many universities of the Arab world. The Arabs produced philosophers, poets, historians, geographers, and scientists. And their influence was felt to a great degree in the Jewish community. New movements appeared in the Jewish community. There were the Karoyim, the Karaites, who denied rabbinic authority, who threatened the vitality of mainstream rabbinic community. There were others who claimed that they were Mashiach. There were revolutions, dynasties rose and fell. The world of Islam was split over the role of succession, tradition. All of this, Mirza Shem will cover throughout this year. And through all of this, the yeshivas continued to produce scholars of the highest magnitude. The Torah that was taught in the yeshivas of Sura and Pumbedisa spread throughout the world. The world turned upside down, but the study of Torah remained the light that was absolute. To best appreciate the world of the Gaonim, I would like to take you back into time, to the yeshivas of Sura and Pumbedisa and Bavel, today's Iraq, so that in a sense we can experience firsthand their life. A writer of the 10th century by the name of Noson HaBavli left us an invaluable firsthand account of the daily life of the yeshivas of the Gaonim of his time. This account, together with the famous letter of Shrira Gaon, who lived 1,000 years ago, is our prime source of knowledge of the period. Many gaps, though, because there's only two sources, have been filled with discovery and publications of thousands of response and letters of that period over the last 150 years. And throughout this series, we will liberally quote from those responses. So please turn now to the first page of your handout. (Clears throat) generally when we think of the word term yeshiva, we think of a school where students who are uninitiated or neophytes come to study at the feet of the great academicians. In a sense, we feel the model is the yeshiva today. Bachurim come in to a normative yeshiva in their high school years, equivalent to their college years. But by the time that a young man is married, a normative yeshiva is no longer the institution for such a young man. Those years of studying at the feet of a great scholar are over. He's studying on his own. The yeshivas of Sura and Pumbedisa were that and much more. Because not only were they yeshivas in the way that we've explained them, but they were also misiftos. And the misifta was the equivalent of the Sanhedrin, of the great conclave of Jewish scholars. The semester of the Misifta, or the year, actually was a 10-month year divided into two parts. The Hebrew months of Nisan and Elul were intercession, were off months. These were the times, of course, of the holidays. Tishrei is the time of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkos. Nisan is a time of Passover, Pesach. It's also the time, as the Talmud points out, of where those who own farms need temporary workers. Nisan is the time of the barley harvest. Tishrei is the time not only of the ingathering of the fruits, but the time of the pressing of the grapes and the olives. It's possible for a young yeshiva person to make enough spending money during those 2 months of the year that he does not have to come on to charity throughout the year. After, we'll begin the year from Tishrei, in Cheshvan, which is the month that we're right now, the semester would begin. And at the end of that semester, not only the semester was held, was not only within the walls of the yeshiva, let it be Pumbedisa or Sura, but in small or large yeshivas throughout the land and in private homes, for 4 months, all the students studied in great depth a single tractate. This was similar to the idea of Daf Yomi, that everyone's studying the same tractate at the same time. This was not bound in terms of a daf at a time, but everyone was studying the same thing. At the end of 4 months, at the fifth month, this is the Chodesh Adar, there was the conclave. Not only would all the students come, but all the Rosh Yeshivas, all the great scholars would come together, and we'd be gathered together in the yeshiva. And they would again go over the Masechta, go over the tractate. We have on the first page, I'm just going to paraphrase this, you could look at it yourself, a description of how it was at the conclave. And these conclaves, of course, were twice a year. One was Adar, at the end of the winter semester, the winter's man. And the other was in Elul, at the end of the summer zman, the summer semester. Again, first was the day it was, they took off Nisan, they started Eor, for 4 months they learned in privately in their own yeshivas or in the major yeshivas, and again everyone came together in Elul. The first seven rows contained 10 seats. The head of the yeshiva sat in the front, and you had rows, these seven rows. Each one, the general placement of your place in the row was generally based on your level of scholarship. the first seven of the first row have the title Rosh Kala, Reshe Kala. If you next time you remember in the Shabbos davening in Yom Kippurkon, we mention Reshe Kala, the heads of the Kala. These were the first seven of the first row. As we're going to continue on, we're going to see they had a dual function. They were involved internally in the yeshiva, in terms of saying a shir, giving a lecture, and they also had responsibilities that since there were 70 members of the Sanhedrin, they were divided into groups of 10. The Reshe Kala, each one had responsibility for those scholars under his wing, so to speak. And in that sense, they were called alufim, like generals, the leaders. So the picture, you see, we're walking into the room here. The picture is there are the first rows, 10 in a row, the first seven rows would be the equivalent of the Sanhedrin. These are the primary, the greatest scholars. Beyond those, and each one had a specific place. You couldn't just decide to, it wasn't musical chairs, you couldn't decide to just move in on someone else's place. As we're going to see, placement was a very important part of the yeshiva. Beyond those, the first rows, there was another group. Reb Nosson HaBavli calls them Bnei Rav, members of the yeshiva. We're going to find in a response of the time, they're called Bnei Kiyume. They were the replacements. They were scholars that basically were fit to be in the Sanhedrin. But there's no place for them. Once a vacancy would be made, they would be able to go and fill that vacancy. Behind those were the rest of the disciples, the Talmidim. There were people, even we're going to see there were people of stature, but these were the students. So we're walking in, and he's all told, according to the scripture of Nosson HaBavli, says there was besides the 70, there was another 400 who sat in the other rows. It seems besides those who were permanently part of the yeshiva, there may have been others, who came for the show. In other words, there were also students, not the first rank students. Evidently, one had to be of a certain rank to be part of the system. But there were others as well. One interesting facet that he describes is the fact of inheritance. Someone dies, his place is open. People do not just normally move over. If the person, the scholar who died, has a son who, in terms of his level of scholarship, is fit to fill his position, he automatically takes that position. Only if the person does not have a son who's fit to fill that position do they move over and someone new comes in. Yeah.
What if, I'm sorry, 70 positions and if a son is not worthy of taking
where
does he go?
Oh, so if the son is not worthy of taking the place, he is put in the place that he would be worthy of. And because a hole opened up now. So let's say he's not fit to be from the Reshe Kala. He can't be from the first seven of the first row. But maybe he could be in another row. Well, therefore, so there's a place open, he could be there. If he's not fit to be here, he could be there. If he's not fit there, maybe perhaps he could be from the Bnei Beirav, in other words, the ones that will eventually take a place. And if he's not fit, he's not fit, and that's it. a very interesting phenomenon is alluded to here. What happens? Life is full of change. It could be 1 year. A person is put. He's of the 70. He's number 43. But because of the stint of whatever his hard work, his brilliance, whatever it is, really right now, he should be number 23. He's really grown. He is not. We don't make new arrangements in terms of his seating. You know, unless there's a death, we don't change the person's seating. But what we do, though, is by virtue, we're going to explain the tests that are taken. If one, you know, scores highly and is really worthy to be number 23 instead of 43, he will be given a stipend commensurate with his wisdom, as they believed in merit pay in those days. So, on one hand, they give those who are, there is a grandfather clause, those that are entrenched don't move unless they're totally disqualified. But on the other hand, in terms of within the system, those who are more worthy, even though they may not move, but they are given a greater stipend. And this is at the end, this is, if you take a look on page 2, on the end of the first paragraph, he alludes to the idea of that the stipend is commensurate with the wisdom. Evidently, it depends how you score on your tests. Who were the members of this yeshiva? Okay, we've walked into the room. We've seen almost 500 people in this room, right? The 70 Sanhedrin, the 400 in rows behind, and there may have been others who were just standing there. Who are they? One of the major commentators of the Talmud, who lived in the 14th, 15th century in southern France, was known as a person called the Meiri. He lived in Provence, Lille. And he wrote he wrote virtually on the whole Talmud, but in his commentary on Ovos, and Pirkei Ovos, of course, begins with the Messiah of the Torah, the transmission from Sinai down. He continues it on to the present day, and he describes the period of the Gaonim. As he points out, and this is confirmed, we know by the response of the Gaonim. The student body, at least in the later period, were representative of the whole world, because the whole world, the whole Jewish world, came to Babylon to learn in the yeshivas. And we could look just briefly on the bottom paragraph of page 2. It reached the point that in all countries, there were many that sent their children there to learn. And we know they were from diverse as Spain and North Africa to the Constantinople. I mean, it was from virtually the whole Jewish world came to the yeshivas in Babylon. They would learn to the point of their individual needs and satisfaction. They would return back home to their families. And through this system, the world became full of divine wisdom. This is the Meiri writes. It's an interesting, in addition to the fact, which is really confirmed by the response, the idea of that it drew from the entire Jewish world, here we have the idea also is that they eventually came home. One of the major problems you have in small communities is with day schools and the children in advance, then they leave and go. You know, they go to Israel, they go to the East Coast, to yeshivas. They don't come back. They're gone, and it depletes the community. Here, what they're saying is they went for a certain amount of time, and they came back home, and they enriched the local communities. Another thing we learn from this preface is that the different titles that were given which corresponds to the different level of accomplishment. There was a title called Chacham, a sage. For that one would have to have completed three of the six orders of the Talmud. There's Moed, which deals with the laws of Shabbos and the holidays, Noshim, which deals with marital law, and Nezikin, which deals with civil and criminal law. Someone who was accomplished in those three areas was called a Chacham, a sage. If he completed four orders, there's the above three plus Kodeshim, the laws of the sacrifices in the temple, then he was called the title Rav. They have titles. If he completed all six orders, that person was fit to be called Gaon. When we're speaking about completed, it seems that they knew them Baal Peh, they knew it by heart. Even though the Talmud was written down at the time, they knew the entire Talmud by heart. And as he points out, the word Gaon, there's a hint, the numerical value of Gaon is 60, which is close to the number of tractates of the Mishnayos. But of course, one only became officially a Gaon, which means the head of the yeshiva, if A says that there was a vacancy. There's even fear fit, but you know, it's Newton's law, you know, that about two bodies can't occupy the same space and time. And with the death, if the person, the Gaon, had not previously named a successor, then there would be an election within the yeshiva, the conclave, as to pick the person they felt would be the most fit for the position. But a qualification to be fit for the position is, it seems from the Miri, one must know the entire Talmud verbatim. How did the testing go? As we spoke previously about testing. It was before the computers, you know what I mean, with the pencils and going through. They had a different system. And in this, again, Nosna Bavli gives us a rare glimpse into life which really, without him, without this work, we really would not be privileged to know. During the first 3 weeks of this conclave, and as we explained before, this is 4 months, they are each studying, this is the material in their own homes or yeshivas or kolels or wherever they are. They're coming together now for this conclave. The conclave, by the way, is called Kala. And the month of this thing, the 2 months of Adar and Elul, are Yarche Kala, the months of Kala. And this is the source of... There's in recent, you know, there's these mini retreats, and they call them Yarche Kala, but it comes from this twice a year event. The first 3 weeks of that month, as you see on the bottom page 3, was they went through the tractate. And the system, how they went through the tractate, is one of the group of the first row started giving the shiur, and started saying, you know, repeating, saying the tractate, until he would reach some sort of a snag. There would be a difficulty that would need clarification. And the first row amongst themselves would start discussing this. And everyone else would be quiet. It's just only the first row would be involved. The Rosh Yeshiva would be listening to all. And at that point, after the points have been made, now he's going to, this is a good point to stop. And for him now, the Rosh Yeshiva, to commence his shiur. So again, he would again repeat the subject matter. When he would come to this point of difficulty, he would provide his own explanation. There would be times that he would throw certain questions to the crowds themselves and have a whole general debate. And finally, when he was finished with his shiur, in other words, he's read up until that point, then again a member of the first row, and everyone must have had a system, you know, how does it go, who goes first and second amongst that row, again would stand up and repeat what the Rosh Yeshiva said.
And again, it would make sure that everyone understands this, and that's how they kept on going throughout the whole month. So people would hear from that, really they would hear from the first row, and then they would hear the Rosh Hashiva, and hear again, they would hear it again re-explained. And this manner, they covered throughout those 3 weeks the entire tractate. Unfortunately, we don't know how much time was spent, and did they do it for 8 hours a day, 12 hours a day, that we don't know. How long was the session itself? But anyone who knows the thing that you have, some of these tractates are very lengthy. Brachos is a very lengthy tractate. Ksubos is a very lengthy tractate. It's not that lengthy, but the way it is, the lengthiest tractate is Bava Basra, which has over 170 folios. So I don't know exactly how much time was spent. Maybe a smaller one, there was less time per day, and a large one, there's more time per day. It's not clear. Fourth week was testing time. And the Rosh Hashiva tested every member of the conclave, from the members of the Sanhedrin, which were the highest, to those who were who were the students. And he would ask them to recite the text. In other words, I guess it was a spot check. And he would ask them questions. And that's how they were ranked. And you see on page 4, this we have worthwhile to read. I have in the. If he would see that one of them was not fluent in the material in the second paragraph, he would make it very difficult for him and reduce his stipend. He would yell at him and rebuke him, inform him of the place that he had erred and hadn't applied himself. So much for self-esteem. He would strongly warn him that if he would repeat the same performance a second time and not pay attention to his studies, no longer receive any stipend at all. At the end of the testing period, they would announce, before they would all leave, they would announce, well, you know, this is the next tractate for the next conclave is this, whatever the decision was. And again, they would be off. Again, they'd have a month's vacation, whatever, and then the semester would begin again for the 4 months and then the fifth. In addition to going over the Talmud itself, we have, from one of the responsa, it's from Rosh Shirigon, it's from the last of the Gaonim, and at the end of this class, and Mirz Hashem, we're going to go, I have on the last page, you can look at the timeline, we'll just go quickly over it, the names of many of the more famous of the Gaonim, for you get just a sense of when these people lived. Not only did they have the Talmud, but they were commentators, which we no longer have, which were from the Rabbonin Savaroy. This is the last subject that we discussed last year. These were this is like 105 years between the end of the Talmud and the beginning of the Gaonim. These scholars clarified the Talmud. That was a Savara. Svara is an explanation, logic. And many of the things that they've written were preserved. And it's not as part of the Talmud itself, even though there are certain sections of the Talmud which have been added because of this Rabbonin Savaroy. But more important, they were running, like we have a Rashi, they were running commentaries on the Talmud that were at least preserved in the time of the Gaonim. So they preserved not only the Talmud, and they explained it, but they had really preserved commentaries, which come like from the period shortly after the close of the Talmud. One purpose, again, let's just review what we have so far. We've discussed the yeshiva in a sense as the conclave, the university, the academy. This is the place where not only the Talmud was studied, but it was standardized. As everyone studied it, everyone got the same form of education. And it was clear there was a testing system to know who was who. There was another function of the mesiftas, the yeshivas of Surim Pumbedisa, and that was their function of answering questions, responsa that were directed to them from across the world. And if I turn to page 5, Mm-hmm. Where, again, this comes from Nosson HaBavli, who describes that in the month of the conclave, they would bring out, says, the questions that would gather throughout this period would be brought to them. So I guess part of the time was spent going through the tractate. I don't know what it would be like the first half a day. Now there's another part of the day which they dealt with the responsa. And responsa deal with every part of the Talmud. Even though they're focusing on a specific area of the Talmud, but the responsa are questions. It affects everything. And again, it says there would be part of the day that they would, the Rosh Yeshiva would have the question read and ask them to respond. And there would be a whole protocol, and they would say, no, no, you first. And he would say, no, 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 you first. Until finally, you know, because to give him the honor, that he would want to hear the opinions of the group. And they would ask him, there would be a whole heated discussion. And then the Rosh Yeshiva himself would be part of the discussion, listen. And finally, he says that he would come to a consensus of what is the proper form, where's the proper way to go. And he would have the scribe write down, says this is exactly in these words I want you to, for this community, if it was in North Africa or Spain or wherever it was, this is the exact answer that I want you to say. And they would go through every single day of this thing. They would go through this. And finally, says they would, at the end of the month, they would again take everything that they had and reread it, just to make sure everyone agrees with this. And he would affix his signature to them. And then again, they would be sent out. In one central clearinghouse for responsa that came from North Africa and Spain was in Egypt, in Fustat. Fustat is old Cairo. It's going to come up again throughout this year. And there, the responsa, and we're going to see the support for the yeshiva, would come through there would be a gabbai, there would be a governor, someone who would take care of the interaction between the communities and the yeshiva. And he would then send all of this thing at proper times just to make sure that, you know, that he knows people are traveling there, maybe yeshiva bachurim, maybe merchants, and he would give the responsa plus donations from the yeshiva, because generally, as we're going to see, when questions were asked, not only did it, but this was a means of their giving support to the yeshivas. They felt it was important, it was vital for the spiritual survival of the Jewish communities to have this connection with the yeshivas. It was important to support them. And they sent the monies with these questions through Fustat. That would be the, and then from there, it would be sent to Babylon. On the way back, the same way. It would be sent through some merchant, whatever, or some yeshiva bachurim that were coming back, to the governor, to the gabbai, to this appointee in Fustat, in Egypt, who again would now make sure to send it to this place and that place and the other place. One thing that he did, though, when it came to him, he made sure that he made copies of every one of these responsa. So not only would it be sent to the communities the question was directed, and, you know, the question came from, was directed to them, but it would be kept as part of the general body of knowledge of Jewry. It's for this reason that one of the major sources of responsa from the Gaonim came from an old synagogue, the Ben Ezra Synagogue in Fustat, in old Cairo, where they found, I mean, many, many scholars worked on this, including Solomon Schechter became famous through his work on this Cairo Geniza. There were boxes and boxes of old tshuva, you know what I mean, that no longer were like in a, they're already, were getting frayed or whatever it is, so they, them again may have copied it for, they had enough copies for their own use, put it in the Geniza, put it in You know, where we put in Seamus, you know, so they were boxes and boxes of this. And they were preserved because of the low humidity. So they were remarkably preserved. And again, it remains for us a tremendous treasure trove of understanding of the period and also in halacha as well. So it just, again, I'm sure that the responsible that were directed in other places had their own governors and appointees, but of course nothing remained of those. To just give you, before we go on, just to give you a sense of how a responsa looked. This is very, and I have it, you can take a look on page 5 in paragraph B, from Amram Bar Sheshna, this is Reish Masifta of Moshe Machasya, that Surah, Moshe Machasya was Surah, the southern Babylon, and this was to all the rabbis and their disciples and the rest of our brethren of the house of Israel that dwell in Barcelona. This took place, this was in the middle, this was like approximately the year 860, like well over 1,000 years ago. And he described, they who are precious and esteemed and beloved by us, may their peace forever be magnified, receive greetings from me and from Mart Semach, the judge of the gateways, Dayona de Bova. Again, if you remember in Yukum Purkon, in the Shabbos davening, we mention the term Dayona de Bova. This is the judge of the gateway. And the heads of the assemblages, Reshe Kala, which we mentioned before. That's the first seven of the first row. And from all the scholars that are ordained, who are in place of the great Sanhedrin, that's the 70 scholars, and from the establishments who are in place of the minor Sanhedrin, and it seems these are the ones who are worthy of replacing them if a vacancy would be made available, and from the other scholars and Tanoim. The text, it just didn't work well in translation, is he has two terms. He has scholars. He has Tanoim, which are the expert on brises, which we find in Talmudic times. And there were Talmidei Chachamim, the disciples of the scholars. Today we call a scholar a Talmud Chacham, which means a disciple of a scholar. But here we have the Chachamim, the Talmideihim. And it would seem, at least from the definition of the Meiri, that a Chacham was a person who perhaps was not adept in all of the Talmud, but at least half. Now this is Moed, Noshim, and Ezekin, three of the orders of the Talmud. Of course, these students were of a lesser level. So we discuss, up and down, we just said the studies of the Masifta, we discussed the responsa. Now just briefly just touch upon this again, you could look at this in your own time, page 6. This is the legislation. They were a legislative body as well. In the times of the Talmud, or pre-Talmud, in the times of the Sanhedrin, when there would be a central body, a Sanhedrin, that central body was able to make legislation. When there was no central body, of course, then one had jurisdiction only of a very narrow area. One could not legislate for all of the Jewish people. There were two yeshivas, one in the north in Pumpadisa, one in the south in Sura. They were divided. As such, they could not make legislation. But there were times when the need was there that they met together. There was a joint session of both yeshivas. And in this joint session, they were able, as the totality of Jewish scholars, in other words, this is the representative body, because now you have North and South coming together in such a format that we're able to make legislation. Of course, the legislation that was made had to follow the guidelines that affect all legislation. Even when the Sanhedrin makes legislation, if the community at large refuses to accept it, it's too much of a burden on them, it's not validated by the community, it does not take effect. Like there's a checks and balances. It's fascinating we find such an instant here in the first in which the first legislation that's recorded, which is in the year 650, in terms of granting a divorce document for a wife who refuses to live with the husband. According to Talmudic law, there's a gradual lessening of her ksuba, the possibility of not getting a ksuba at all, but just going gently with this, in other words, to perhaps there'll be reconciliation. There was a unique problem in Gaonic times that the Talmudic solution did not work. And here we have, in the middle here, page 6 in the second paragraph, and this is written by from Reshvira Gaon. After the period of Rabbanan Savaroy, and this is in the early time of the Gaonim, Marava Marav Huna, who dwell in Aden, is like, may rest in peace, because the daughters of Israel would hire non-Jews to force their husbands to give them a get. They couldn't wait. And there were those that forced husbands to write a get under duress, and there was a doubt as to the validity of such a forced get, because a divorce document, a get, has to be given with one with free will. So terrible problems would arise. And therefore, as a response to this new situation, they enacted this thing of immediately giving a get. However, looking in the third paragraph, the Rambam, writing after Shrira Gaon, writing some 200 years later, says that that which were established by the Gaonim did not take hold across the majority of Israel and therefore is not binding. So just finally find this, the idea of checks and balances. We find just mentioned just briefly, they made the legislation that a ksuba could be collected from non-real estate. According to Talmudic law, it could only be collected from real estate and not from movable property. The condition changed because Jews originally were owners of land. They had estates. In Arabic times, Jews were deprived of those lands. They really could not pay their debts with land because they didn't own land. Or it became common that a Jew would not own land, and therefore, in response, again, they in joint session of the yeshivas of Surah and Pumbedisa, they made this legislation. I just like to briefly go over a thing, which is something we've gone over really last year, before the period of the Gaonim. Originally, again, we're speaking about a masifta, a conclave. The masifta really did not exist in Babylon, only in Israel, until the time that Rav came to Babylon in the year 219. He originally came to Nahardo, which is in the very north of Babylon. And it seems shortly afterwards, with the death of the grandson of Yehuda Hanasi, that Rav left Nahardo, went south to Sur, and established not only a yeshiva, but a masifta. It was an area of a conclave, where it wasn't he was just teaching, but really it was a place where, as we've described before, all the scholars come together. Rav died in the year 247. In Rav's time, there were two yeshivas, one in Nahardo in the north, one in Sura in the south. When Rav died, for the most part, his disciples went to Shmuel, who was the Rosh Hashiva of Nahardo, under his guidance, and for the next 7 years, 6 years, the conclave met solely in Nahardo. So the Masifta was just in Nahardo. Shmuel died in the year 253, Evidently, there was a question about to reconvene this and at what level and who should do this, because there was one in Eretz Yisrael already. The Talmidim were not on the same level now as Rav or Shmuel. After discussion, the Masifta again was reopened. It went south again to Surah. This is the year 257. It was there for the next 40 years. In the interim, Nahardaw, which was a major Jewish center, had a reversal. It was attacked and conquered by a foreign body. There was a city called Palmyra in northern Syria that destroyed Nahardaw. The scholars fled. Many of them fled to a city just south of Nahardaw called Pumpadisa. And it was in Pumpadisa that a yeshiva, not a masifta, yeshiva under the guidance of Rav Yehuda. When Rav Huna died in the year 297, Rav Yehuda's yeshiva became not just a yeshiva for students, it became a masifta, a place of a conclave. There was a brief period of time, 2 years after it became a masifta. Again, this is the Rav Yehuda died. There was a question: where should it continue on? Again, this problem: where should they meet? It was either for many years, it was either south, now north. What should they do? They decided they'll continue the northern yeshiva Pumpadisa, and Rabba would be its head. Rabba didn't want to do it. He felt that he was young. Rav Chisda, who was a disciple, a colleague of Rav Huna's, was still south. He felt that he could only be a student of Rav Chisda's. And even though it was a yeshiva, but he didn't actively act as the head of this conclave, and he deferred to Rav Chisda, went south. By the time Rav Chisda died, though, Rabba had already moved north. And Pumpadisa was basically a permanent yeshiva, a conclave, until the time of the end of the Gaonim in the year 1038. In the year 352, when Rava died, and when Rabba was alive, I know these are just names for many of you, but we've discussed them. Just time doesn't allow to go into detail, but it's really in the classes we gave last year, which are on tape. For many years, there was only one place, Pumpadisa. When Rava died in the year 352, they opened a new place south. First, it was in Nersh, and finally, under Rav Ashi, was Mosa Machasya, a suburb of Sura, and there again, almost semi permanently, till the end, Sura became a place of a conclave. So we had Pumpadisa to the north, Sura to the south. Except during Rav Ashi's time, Rav Ashi was such a stellar figure that even those who were the scholars and students of Pumpadisa really deferred to Rav Ashi. And even after Rav Ashi's death, the respect that was given to the conclave of Sura continued on. And this respect is reflected, we have on page 8 here, of the special privileges that the yeshiva of Sura enjoyed over the yeshiva of Pumpadisa. Originally, and this refers most certainly to Rav Ashi's time, they did not appoint the Rosh Yeshiva Pumpadisa from the ranks of the yeshiva itself. They would bring a member of the yeshiva of Sura to become Rosh Yeshiva. So it became it was a place of a conclave. Yes, it was a place, it was a minor Sanhedrin, but it was subservient. It seems in Gaonic times, though, this was not the case. Pumpadisa produced their own. But as we say, you can look at the rest yourself, the second one. Wherever it says that they would be an assemblage of the Reish Galusa, this would be the closest thing to a Jewish king, together with the Rosh Yeshivas of Bavel, and there would be one Shabbos, they would all come together, the Rosh Yeshiva of Sura would be given all the privileges. The Rosh Yeshiva of Pumpadisa would be given secondary privileges. For the most time of the period, the title, even though they're both Gaonim and Yeshiva heads, in terms of documents, in terms of protocol, the term Gaon was given to the Rosh Yeshiva of Sura and not to the Rosh Yeshiva of Pumbedisa. This only changed in the very end of the period. So again, just to give you a sense of that there were two places. One was to the north, Pumbedisa. One was the south, Sura. Sura originally began by Rav, approximately in the year 220, only really grew to this very special place during the time of Rav Ashi. This was from the year 371, and it was from that time on that of the two, Sura seemed to have, the preference. I'd like now just to briefly touch upon, so we went upon, just what did we cover? What they studied, how they sat, what they studied, the function not only as an academy, but also as a place to answer questions throughout the world, and also a place where legislation was made. And of the two institutions, it would seem, at least in terms of protocol and respect, that Pumbedisa was considered the junior of the two. Even though there were times that the greatest scholars actually came from Pumbedisa. But still there was they retained this the former honor. I once saw a cartoon, beautiful little cartoon. Moses is at Mount Sinai, this is in cartoon form. He's standing, he's holding the two Luchas Abris, he's standing the two tablets under his hand, and he's looking up and the caption is, "But what about funding?" How were the yeshivas funded? Well, the description that I will just briefly, and it's really given in great detail, which I think you should take home and really look at. What the condition is, what occurred at the end of the period, probably from the year 825 and on. Up until the year 825, it seems that the head of the Reish Galusa had all the entire privileges of naming judges, of rulership throughout the Jewish world, at least in that area, around Babylon. After the year 825, there was a falling out between the Reish Galusa and the Caliph, the Arab king in Baghdad. And because there were certain internal struggles within the Jewish community that the Jews lost prestige, there was a stream of anti-Semitism. Whatever the causes were, from that time on, the Reish Galusa's power came not because he could use the caliph, he could use the Arab king to enforce his dictates, because the Arab king would no longer support him. He would have to be supported through the Rosh Yeshivas. Does it have that? And if they needed support of the Rosh Yeshivas, well, it had came at a cost. And the cost was that they all shared equally in the appointment of judges, of religious life throughout the diaspora. There's at least the area around Babylon. So before, from Talmudic times, it was solely in the hands of the appointment of judges was solely in the hands of the Reish Galusa, the exilarch, the Jewish king, so to speak. From that time on, from the year 25, it was shouldered jointly. And with the appointment came finances, because there were taxes. And here we have in great detail that this is in terms of the Reish Galusa, when he made an appointment of a judge, it was done with the express permission of the heads of the yeshivas. They charged taxes. They would just send one judge, who would be an expert. That judge would find other esteemed members of the community to join him in the court. So there would be the dayan appointed, plus two talmidei chacham, local talmidei chacham. There were taxes raised that he took care of, this judge, support for the community. There were specific taxes. There was a poll tax given to every person. There was taxes. There were charges gone on every document that was made. And there was no document, legal document, was allowed to be made without the taxes paid and the express permission of this judge. He had the monopoly of all legal documents. Otherwise, as you can read, so there was excommunication against anyone who violated this. Butchers were charged taxes on the meat. And all this money went to provide the livelihood of the judge, the livelihood of all the scribes and everyone who was involved here in this infrastructure. And everything else, which was considerable, was sent back to the exilarch, to the Resh Galusa, to support his efforts in leading the entire Jewish community. When there were bribes that needed to be made to the non-Jewish heads of state, it was the exilarch who had to make those bribes. It was from this money. It was this money that supported the Jews in general throughout the diaspora. And the judge was not only a judge, but he was the Resh Galusa's representative to collect all these monies. And just as the Resh Galusa had this system, was in place for the Resh Galusa, it was the same system for the Rosh Yeshivas. They also appointed judges with the same system of a poll tax and fees for documents, and there was taxes on meat. Again, every community paid within its ability. And this is how this is one major area of support of the yeshivas. Another, of course, were donations that were sent directly to the yeshivas. They came in two forms. It was just money that was sent. There were others that were sent to when the shilas were asked, responses were given back. Again, there were funds that were sent. So the response was a form of collection. When money was given from other communities, they didn't know what, when. They said, this is given for the yeshivas as a whole. The original setup was two-thirds went to Sura, one-third went to Pumpadisa. Rav Isaac Halevi, the historian, theorizes the reason was two-thirds went to Sura. Sura in southern Iraq was not a major Jewish community, in terms of a population center. So they had less local support, so they needed more of this external support given their way. This is whereas Pumpadisa was in a major population center, just they had a local population to give them that support. Only at the end of the Gaonic period, when the yeshiva of Sura waned, and they had much less students to support, was there a change in the division. So again, how were the yeshivas supported? They were supported by taxes that came through the appointment of judges who really collected this whole judicial system was paid for. Everything extra went back to support the yeshivas. They were supported by direct donations. They were supported by donations that were given together with the responsa. And of course, the monies that came in were distributed to the students, commensurate, of course, with their wisdom that we had before. There was a whole system you got according to how you scored on your tests. Speaking about incentives to study for your tests, this is a tremendous incentive, and that's why one of the reasons they produce such scholars. Towards the end of the Gaonic era, there were many disruptions in Iraq. There are many wars, which we're going to discuss. As a result, we have on page 13, Rav Shriragon writes to the community in Keruin, which is in North Africa, which is part of the... This particular letter was written to Spain, but it's within a collection that deals with letters to North Africa. Here he bemoans the fact they lost their income. We have no districts. Now, everyone had a special district for taxation. There's no district anymore. He says, we have to go out and collect. Says, we have to go and send mishalochim, and there's no system in place. We don't appoint judges. I mean, evidently there was a whole turmoil which really prevented them from really exercising any control. He says, our money and lands are depleted. All we have is the writings of our forebears. They had not only the Talmud, but every single responsa that was sent to these communities was copied in Babylon itself. So they had an extensive library of the old responses. That's all we have. We have nothing else. And he begged them, the community, to help support them. There were many letters that came out of this genre from the yeshiva, Rosh Yeshiva of Sura, Shmuel Bar Chofni as well, also asking for funds, the same tone, and asking in a sense that we can help you as well. Send us your questions. We have scholars, just as it happened before, says we should continue on. Of course, besides the internal problems in Babylon, which took their financial support from them, there were other factors that deprived them of their financial support in the diaspora. Says the communities, as we're going to, and this is going to be at a later date, we're going to expand upon this, started becoming less dependent on the yeshivas in Babylon. In other words, they stopped sending out and they started developing their own. In other words, normally as it was, which is becoming a current trend here in America today, someone who wants to go to yeshiva, very often the place of choice is going to Eretz Yisrael. That's where the learning is. Brisk, Mir, whatever yeshiva it is. And that's how it was from Spain and North Africa. It says, if you want to send, it says, you send to the yeshivas in Babel. There came a greater trend, though, of keeping the kids home and creating first-rank yeshivas at home. Of course, in that sense, the people feel, well, tzedakah, we have to support our local yeshivas. And as a result, the support for the Babylonian yeshivas suffered, which eventually led to after the passing of Rav Haigon, the last of the Gaonim, the yeshivas no longer served in Babylon, only served as local yeshivas, just as yeshivas in Spain and in France and North Africa served as local yeshivas, no longer a central body because they no longer had that support. I'd like now, before we end, I'd like to just on page 14, and you have to realize this is the beginning of a long series, and this is the introduction. I'd like to just briefly go over key periods of time of this whole period, which Yemirat Hashem, we will go in greater length in subsequent lectures. Again, let's just summarize what we have. We've described the yeshivas in Sur and Pompadis, which are not just simply academies, were conclaves of scholars. Every 6 months, once in the end of the 5 month period, they went over a tractate in great depth in a conclave of the greatest scholars. They did this as one tractate, a half a year, two tractates a year. They were tested on this. They were, each one was giving a rank because of his test score. They were supported commensurate to their wisdom, to their rank on their tests. It was a place where response were sent out to the whole Jewish world. The whole Jewish world viewed that this is the place where their questions could be answered. This was a place where legislation at times, when the need was there, was made not by individual yeshivas, but by a joint session of both yeshivas. They were supported by local taxation, and it was through the appointment of judges. They were supported by donations throughout the Jewish world. The yeshivas came to an end at a time where it was impossible to finance yeshivas through local taxation because of the turmoil of all of the wars. Really, no money was coming in. There was no, really, the communities were really could not function as a source of income. Money still kept in coming in from throughout the Jewish world, but at a smaller rate the last Gaonim had to plead for both greater funds and greater interaction. Send us your questions. But finally, at the end, the last Gaon, Rav High Gaon, it was not really resurrected. The Yeshiva in Bovel just now became, instead of a central conclave in Masifta, it remained as a yeshiva, just like all the many other yeshivas throughout the Jewish world. That was the end of the period of the Gaonim. Yeshivas continued on in Iraq. And in fact, they still even gave titles to the Rosh Yeshivas Gaon, but it was an honorary title, a remembrance of better times. But it no longer functioned as a central body for Jewry. And the limelight now turned to Spain and to Germany and France. The period after the Gaonim is the period of the Rishonim, is the period of Spain, of the Rif, of the Rambam. There was a period of Rashi. This is the next period. Just, I'll go quickly to the timeline on page 14. The first Gaon of Pumpadisa, and this was established in year 589. Because of there were tremendous problems with the Persians, it was very difficult for them to come together as they did formally. Conditions got slightly better in 589. They reestablished the Yeshiva Pumbedisa, not just the plain Yeshiva again, as a place of a conclave. In 609, 20 years later, Sura was established. Sura even had was more difficult politically to reinitiate the Yeshiva. 622, Muhammad flees Mecca for Medina. This is the year of the Muslim calendar. 10 years later, Muhammad dies. At his death, the conquest of the rest of the civilized world began. In 637, Ctesiphon, the capital of the Persian Empire, just fell to Omar the First. Ctesiphon was not that far from Sur and Pumbedisa. 659, Rav Yitzchak Gaon of Peres Shapur, which is in Nahar Dor. In Nahar Dor, even when Pumbedisa and Sura had these yeshivas, Nahar Dor, which was began a yeshiva when it was difficult politically, was still in existence. The head of that yeshiva greets Ali ben Abi Talib. Ali, which we'll go in greater detail, was the son-in-law of Muhammad. He was the fourth of the caliphs, the Shiites. You know, this is remember, says Ayatollah Khomeini is a Shiite in Iran. They're Shiites. They are. It's called, says, it's Shiite Ali. It's the party of Ali. They believe that the direction of the Muslim movement could only be given through Ali and his descendants. Ali has a very great place in just understanding even current history, which we'll, Mirtz Hashem, will devote some time to. He met him, the Rosh Yeshiva. Evidently, he made a favorable impression upon him. He came out with 90,000 Jews, came out to greet Ali. And evidently, because of that, the position of the yeshivas was cemented. And for the most part, in the early period, they treated them very well. The Arabs treated the yeshivas very well. In 661, is the founding of the Umayyad Caliphate of Muawiyah. This is 2 years afterwards. Ali was assassinated. Muawiyah, who we're going to discuss at length later, began a whole new dynasty, and its capital was Damascus. 750, there was another group that exterminated the family of the Umayyads, and they began a new caliphate. And in 762, they built up the Caliph al-Mansur, the second of this dynasty, founded Baghdad. At that time, just as this was happening in the Arab world, in 765, Rav Acha Gaon, Rachoy Gaon, this is the author of the Shiltis, emigrates to Israel. In 769, Rav Yehudoi Gaon, who's the author of the Hilchos Psuchos, the Halachas Gedolos, is based on his teachings, became the Gaon of Sura. Again, these are people that, those are studying the yeshiva, or Choy Goin or Yudoy Goin are names that, that one comes in contact with. The following group are Gaonim from both Pumbedisa and Sura, where there was a tremendous, during that period of time, tremendous interaction between the Gaonim and the communities outside of Israel and Spain and North Africa. Rav Paltoy Goin of Pumbedisa is supposed to have written the whole Talmud and sent it to Spain. Rav Sar Sholem Goin of Sura was in 848. Paltoy is in 841. 853 is Rav Natronoi Goin. In 858 is Rav Amram Goin. The Siddur, which is the prototype of the Siddur we use today, was sent as a responsa from Rav Amram Goin. I mean, of course, he davened the Siddur, but he sent them. This is the exact order that we davened. 871 is Rav Tzemach bar Rav Paltoy Goin. This is from Pumbedisa. 928, Rav Sadia Goin became the Goin of Sura. At this point, Sura had fallen down. It needed a rejuvenation. There was feelings it should be closed entirely. Rav Sadia Goin, originally from Fayum in Egypt, a tremendous scholar, a person with many different facets, but in terms of being a Goin, first and foremost, he was a Talmudic scholar. He became the Goin of Sura. He had many political problems during his period of time. After the death, at his death, 942, it continued on, but it was the beginning of a real decline. In 968, Rav Shrira Goin became the Goin. He was already 70 years old. In 998, he died at the year 100. And Rav Hai Goin became his successor. At this time, Sura really was, its influence was almost negligible. In 1038, Rav Hai Goin died, and this is the end of the era. Again, we went through this just very, very fast. This is the first lecture of the series. We're going to go back and touch all of this as we go. The important thing to have the sense of this lecture is, to have know what the function of the yeshivas in Sura and Pumbedisa was and how it interacted on the world. And it was a mutual relationship. It acted on the world. It needed the financial support of the world, needed support sending students from the world. And at the end, there was a demise of this thing. At the end of Rav Hai Goin, Rav Hai Goin seems to have been eulogized as the greatest of all the Goinim. At his death, though, it just did not continue. The support was not there. They just feel that it was just enough to support what they had locally, and a whole new era began. Okay? Are there any questions? Yes. We're really going to discuss this in further lectures, but they did have experts on Tanakh. Tanakh was a subject studied. It was not studied in the yeshiva because it was considered a preliminary subject. In other words, there were more people that were well-versed in Tanakh than they were in Talmud. It was understood that one had to become well-versed in Tanakh before one began the study of Talmud. In terms of philosophy, it was a very controversial subject. It really only became part of the study of Jews only already in the 9th century, well into the Gaonic period. It became, was it the rage amongst Muslim scholars? It seems much less amongst Jewish scholars. Rav Sadia Goin was one of the few who was quite adept in the Greek philosophy, the Arabic Greek philosophy of the time. But these are all subjects which we'll discuss at length as we go on. Yeah. Uh, Okay, the two questions asked. First one is, what about the libraries? We do not, unfortunately, have the libraries of the response that they had in the yeshivas. Over ages, they were lost. They were not recopied. They fell into disuse, whatever. And the climatic conditions, it's very humid there, and documents really don't have the staying power that they have in other areas. There were collections that are alluded to in many of the early comments of collections of responsa. A few of them have remained and were reprinted. And as I said before, the Cairo Geniza gave us a whole new, besides that which these minor collections, which is only like a hundredth of the original, maybe a thousandth of the original. But again, the Cairo Geniza and the Ben Ezra Synagogue and Fustat and Old Cairo is an additional source of these. In terms of the Crusades really did not affect Babylon. They did affect Eretz Yisrael, which at this time also had yeshivas, which we will discuss in subsequent lectures. They were totally wiped out. The Crusaders totally wiped out Jewish life. The question is about the issue of Nahar Dor. We mentioned this in passing. Let me just give you just a little rundown of Nahar Dor. Josephus mentions Nahar Dor. Nahar Dor is the first Jewish community that was established by those who left Babylon. The 11 years before destruction of the first temple, Yechoniah, a Jewish king, was taken in shackles to Babylon with the cream of Jewish society. The Cheresh and Mazgir, they were called. They established a synagogue, this is in Nahar Dor, called Shof V'Yosef. They used stones imported from Yerushalayim. And this was the first continuous establishments of Jewish scholarship and life in Babylon. Josephus describes about they collected, this was a central, because it was a walled city, they collected shkolim, they collected the half shekels that were given each year to support the Beis HaMikdash. They supported it there, and it was such that they needed an entourage of 10,000 Jewish troops to take all that money to Yerushalayim. It was a very large city. It was a major, major city. Shmuel evidently grew up there. He became a Rosh Yeshiva there, but it only became a Masifta. Only when conditions changed in Israel that the grandson of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, died. It was felt that already the level of scholarship in Israel was not greater than that of Babylon, so they felt that they had the right to create their own in Babylon. It would be similar to what happened later on. Nahar Dor, though, after the time of Shmuel, had its had its reversal because of Palmyra conquered it. It came back again, though, afterwards. They resettled it. Rav Nachman, which we discussed last year, was the Dayan, was the Rosh Yeshiva in Nahar Dor. Many great scholars were in Nahar Dor. Later on, when political situation was, they couldn't function, they couldn't have these yeshivas in Sur and Pumbedisa. Nahar Dor was a little out of the way, evidently, the political conditions there, because every place had their own governor and had their own, that they were able to move and have it in Nahar Dor. But at the first opportunity, they tried to reestablish it again in the old places, first Pumbedisa, then Sur. Yeah. Right.
And, I mean,
400
is not that many. So what happened to other people that
were like? Right. So they had smaller yeshivas, which it seems also were supported through the big yeshiva. But they had to be fit for this. In other words, you have to realize that a student there had to hear all this discussion from the Rosh Yeshivas, had to understand all of this, assimilate all this, and recite verbatim the whole tractate. So this is already, we're dealing with a scholar of really of tremendous stature. So there were lower things that you had to be worthy of getting to this highest place. Yeah, but it was very, the testing was very rigorous and the standards were very rigorous, but they did support, they called the B'nai Tarbitza, they supported other institutions, and those members that were not bound by this to study, you know, that particular tractate. They could go according to their own ability and their own needs.
So let
me explain this. There were actually, the Resh Galusa had a district. Now, it was divided up. This is your place. Here, Resh Galusa, you appoint your judges, and you appoint the judge in this area, who will, from this, arrange the whole organization to collect the taxes. The Rosh Yeshiva of Sura had his area. And the Rosh Yeshiva of Pumbedisa had his area. Each one had districts. And that's what he was bemoaning with Shriragon, is because, I guess, because of the political situation, it was impossible for them to have any organized Jewish life in these areas. And therefore, not only weren't they able to exercise any influence, but they weren't able to have the support. So everyone had their own specific areas. Like, you would say, Resh Galusa had this city, that city, or these areas. And that's how it was divided up. It seems, again, the original time is the Resh Galusa controlled the judgeships throughout that whole Middle Eastern area. It was only because he lost his base of power. He wasn't supported by the caliph, the Arab, and he wouldn't support him. And therefore, says, you know, people would say, who cares about you? So they need at least the moral authority of the Rosh Yeshivas. And one, that he needed the moral authority, if not the political authority of the caliph, but the moral authority, as they says, you know, you just have too much authority. You'll have enough, you know, but it's more important that the yeshivas be supported. Oh, I can. Yeah, it doesn't. The question was about what happened about Germany and France, where their response, I don't think we have record of it. I think what happened was the furthest that they had direct influence was on Spain. And the reason was, at least originally, was that Spain was all part of this Muslim world. Once you got to Germany and France, everyone was at war with each other. You have to realize there was not great love lost between the French and the Spanish. You know, especially, you know, the Arabs, the famous Battle of Tours, Poitiers is at Tours, where Charles Martel was able to, save Europe from the Arabs, there was no great thing, and therefore there was really very little penetration. So that was probably a major reason why you didn't have it. Also, that in that period of time, Germany and France were not centers of Torah on the same level as Spain and North Africa. It only came into their own towards the end of the Gaonic period.
Okay. Yeah. So trying to understand how the semester was organized. There was 4 months where students would study a tractate at home.
Whatever, in their local yeshivas or whatever.
And then they would come to Pompidisa.
Right.
And sewer for the 1 month test.
Correct. Right. They would hear it all over again. You thought you knew it. But you thought, let's hear it again. So they heard it again. And it was only after that, the first 3 weeks, they heard it and heard all the discussion and all the different lectures on it. Then they were tested.
So what happened, what was going on in the actual yeshiva during the months when the students were at their respective homes?
They probably had shiurim, they had probably lectures from Rosh Yeshivas, and they learned like in the kolel with chavrusas, they learned together.
They were gone, they were home, right?
Where?
The students went home to their communities.
They went only home,
Were they home?
Yeah, well, In Surim Pumbedisa Shir, the yeshiva, there were those who stayed throughout the year, you know. But there were those who went to their local homes, their local kolos, the local yeshivas, wherever they were. If you lived 300 miles away, you know, it was doable. So you were there, so then you came back and you learned these members of the Sanhedrin, or, you know, these, you know, probably many of them had their own communities in yeshivas where they were. They didn't stay in Surim Pumbedisa the whole year. And they had their disciples, and so someone may have been on the first row, but he was just there only that month. And the other month he had his own yeshiva with his own disciples. Yeah, so there were local yeshivas, and during those 4 months, this was also like a local yeshiva. It was only in that fifth month that it became this conclave. Yeah. Okay, it's the last one. They owned written texts. In other words, it was the time that was being, it was written, but it seems that they had to know it bal peh. They worked off of it, but they were trained. From their earliest training, they were trained to memorize. It's a whole different way of learning than we learn now. It seems that they were trained to memorize it. Today, you know, it's a lot easier. You know, everything has a daf. You know, I mean, you can remember like the page and the side, and every page has a certain, you know, you can, in your mind, you could picture it where it's at. There with the scrolls was a little more difficult. You know, and but memory was very much part of the system of education. Not only understanding, as we see, but memory as well.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.